This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Even now, 4.5 years later, remains from those who died on September the 11th are still being found in New York City. 2 weeks ago, construction workers in New York found hundreds of bone fragments on the roof of a building adjacent to Ground Zero. The Deutsche Bank building is scheduled for demolition. It was heavily damaged on 9/11. And many family members of those killed are angry and upset that a thorough search wasn't conducted years ago. Meanwhile, over on New York's Staten Island, there's another controversy over the disposal of 500,000 tons of ash from the World Trade Center. Amid the pulverized concrete and glass and everything else, some families believe the ash includes the cremated remains of their loved ones and are angry that it's all being left on top of a garbage dump. So far, at least, forensic investigators have been unable to identify any remains of more than 1,100 of those killed on 9/11. The issues include practicality and cost, moral obligations to the dead and their families, and there are broader questions of the ways in which we remember and memorialize our dead. Later in the program, the making and marketing of a documentary film. But first, how to memorialize the dead, especially when there are no remains to bury. Given the magnitude of the loss suffered on 9/11, how far should the government go to help family members? What is finality? Should cost be a consideration? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. We begin in New York with reporter Martha Moore, who's a reporter for national reporter for USA Today. She's been covering the events surrounding 9/11 from the very start. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
There's controversy over how to honor those who died on September the 11th, almost from the beginning, including what kind of memorial should be built at Ground Zero. Can you bring us up to date on that? A plan was approved less than an hour ago, at least preliminary plan to rebuild at Ground Zero.
Yes, just today, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which owns the World Trade Center site, reached an agreement with Larry Silverstein, who had leased the World Trade Center about 6 weeks before the September 11th attack and therefore is still the leaseholder. Mm-hmm. They had been trying to renegotiate their deal for who was going to build what. And what they reached, the agreement they reached today, actually scales back Larry Silverstein's role in developing it. He will no longer control the two of the five buildings that will be built on the site, including the Freedom Tower, the 1,776-foot tall building that is supposed to be the centerpiece of the rebuilding.
Mm-hmm. And this should allow things to move along. They've been stalled by this dispute. Nevertheless, they're now stalled by this evidence that people found on top of the Deutsche Bank building, the third time since 9/11 that bone fragments have been found in various parts of that building. Why wasn't the building searched thoroughly 3 years ago?
Well, I believe the building was searched 3 years ago, but I think the fragments that are being found now are very small. The fragments on the rooftop are coming when workers are trying to decontaminate the building before it is deconstructed or torn down. Mm-hmm. And they're quite small, some as small as the size of your fingernail. So I think in the past, the searches have been for, first of all, for people or bodies, and now it's I don't think we really know why they weren't found, why these haven't been found until now, but they are quite small.
Mm-hmm. Some of the family groups involved have prevailed on Senator Chuck Schumer of New York to ask for the deployment of an elite military unit called JPAC. This is the group that normally searches Vietnam and Korea for the remains of American soldiers. He's asked them to get involved in the search for remains of 9/11 victims. Is he likely to get their help?
Well, JPAC has said that they have not officially been asked to help. They helped immediately after 9/11. They sent a forensic dentist to New York, and they also helped at the Pentagon. But since then, they have not been back. And their point of view is that they are an agency that does what it is asked to do. And if asked, then it would be a request they would consider.
Yeah,
but they haven't been asked.
They haven't been asked. And is there any indication that they're going to get a request from, I guess, the Secretary of Defense?
I have not heard that that is under consideration.
There's another controversy we mentioned earlier, and that involves the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island. We're going to be speaking with a family member there in just a moment. But briefly, can you tell us what that controversy is about?
The Fresh Kills landfill is an enormous landfill on Staten Island that had been closed not long before the 9/11 attack. After the buildings collapsed, the Freshkills landfill is where all of the debris from the World Trade Center site was taken. And once it got there, it was searched very carefully for remains and personal possessions. However, there was an enormous amount of ash that was mixed in with the debris, as you would expect from buildings that burned and then collapsed. And there's a very strong belief among some family members that those ashes necessarily include the remains of people who died at the Trade Center. And they would like those ashes taken out of the landfill and reburied in a more appropriate, what they believe to be a more appropriate location.
Certainly not on what they say is a garbage dump.
It is a garbage dump.
You've written some wonderfully descriptive stories of the scene out there at Freshkills. Can you tell us what it looks like?
Well, ultimately, one day they hope that it will be a beautiful park, but it's been a landfill for a long time, and until March of 2001, the place where the Trade Center debris was taken was an active landfill. So when the Trade Center debris started to arrive, it was a big hill covered with about 18 inches of dirt. And after the Trade Center debris arrived, it was a big hill covered with about 1.6 million tons of debris. And it, since then, they have begun to cap that landfill with more dirt. But, you know, it's a bare earth hill with a terrific view of lower Manhattan. But it's windy and dusty, and it doesn't smell very good because it's a landfill. There are pipes to release the methane gas into the air. And it will be that way for a long time.
Joining us now is Diane Horning. Her son Matthew was killed at the World Trade Center. She has since founded the group WTC Families for Proper Burial. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Your group has a petition pending in court due to be heard next week. What are you hoping to win in that case?
We are hoping to have the remains that are in Freshkills removed from the garbage heap and taken to a more suitable location where we can have a proper burial. In a cemetery.
And is there any way that you know of to separate the cremated remains of people from the half a million tons of other dust and ash?
Well, no, there isn't any way to do that. But I think the choice is, do we bury my son in a garbage dump because we can't separate it? Or do we bury perhaps his desk with him in a proper place because we can't separate it? And I think we err on the side of humanity and morality and bury it all in a decent location. I think it's important to understand that we not only think that there are ashes there, but with the medical examiner's agreement, we know that there are small tissue particles, there are bone fragments. If you look at what's being found at the Deutsche Bank right now, that 130 Liberty, they're finding pieces that are a 16th of an inch. Diameter is a 16th of an inch, and that really could easily have fallen through whatever sifting they did. But there is a lot of evidence that the sifting was done not until after a month or 40 days when the dumping began. Mm-hmm. A lot of material escaped that sifting, and there were times when the sifting mechanisms were unattended. There's a lot of material in there that's not ash, but that notwithstanding, we would like it taken off a garbage heap.
It's difficult to put a monetary price on morality.
Yes.
Nevertheless, there have been estimates. I know you dispute them, but there are estimates that this might cost something on the order of $500 million.
Well, we have asked Mr. Bloomberg and the Bloomberg administration to please give us their cost estimates and explain them to us, because we have gone to engineering concerns, we have gone to the people who did the sifting at the landfill, and we have worked out what it would cost in many different locations, depending on where it was taken. The biggest expense seems to be transporting it. So it would depend on, the price goes up as we find a place further away to transport it. But no one has given us a figure anywhere near that. And so we don't really understand where they're getting the figure, but so far they have never shown us where they arrived at those figures.
As I understand it, some of your son's personal effects were found in the process of sifting through that material, his wallet.
Yes, it was.
And I know that you received a few tiny fragments that were identified as being from his body, not much, but something more than many families have gotten.
That's true.
Can you tell us about the importance then of looking through of this ash? Again, there were more than 1,000 families who got nothing of their family members.
There's actually 1,151 for whom there's been no recovery. I think it's very important for us. It's not closure, because I don't really think there is such a word, but there's a certain solace in having a cemetery to go to, a place of reflection and a place of respect for the dead. We don't worship the body, but we do honor it. And as a national sentiment, we bury our dead. We look at the military. My neighboring town has just returned a fragment of a helicopter pilot from Vietnam. 35 years it took them to find this fragment in the jungles of Vietnam, but the importance was there because it is important to our nation. We bury our dead. It's the most insulting thing not to. I mean, all the way through history, you think of Antigone. You know, she defied her father. She defied the law because she needed to bury her brother. It's the ultimate insult and indignity. We need to bury them.
I understand that. Other people do have to think about the money, though. Do you understand their concerns?
I do and I don't. I would say that the entire process cost $67 million. FEMA paid $67 million to take everything out of Ground Zero when it was burning, when it was dangerous, bring it to Fresh Kills and do the processing until it closed. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how asking for less can produce more, because we're not asking for all of that forensic work to be done again. We want a commingled grave. So again, I'm saying that it is not that expensive. The amount of money that we're asking for is less than Mr. Bloomberg spent on his mayoral campaign. When you look at the way money has been misspent that was allotted for the recovery of September 11th, I don't think that we should have to sacrifice the proper burial of our dead to make up for that. I think that we need, if we can give...
Diane, yes. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I wanted to thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Diane Horning is co-founder of WTC Families for Proper Burial. She joined us today on the phone from her home in New Jersey. More after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Martha Moore, before we lose the story of the Fresh Kills ashes, I did want to ask, this suit that's being filed in court is going to be heard. Its prospects, of course, we don't really know at this point, but the city has been resisting this move to rebury these ashes.
Yes, they have. And that's why the Hornings are in court. I think there's the issue of expense, which would be enormous, obviously. There's the issue of how to extract the ashes, which are basically mixed in with all of the larger debris from the Trade Center. And also, I think, you know, the Fresh Kills landfill is supposed to be turned into a large state park. And I think there's political or governmental desire to keep that process moving forward.
And it, of course, would have to stop if you had to uncap the soil and take it would extend it by some years, probably. Anyway, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Bill's on the line. Bill calling from Tallahassee in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was a volunteer with the Red Cross after 9/11 and a forensic dentist, and I was in the area, and the fragments were so small that you could not make even, of course, DNA would be the only way, but the fragments were so small there was no way to make any identification other than the personal effects that you found.
Mm-hmm.
They were just minute scraps, and the expense would be phenomenal to try to extract those. And you don't even know how much is actually mixed or commingled with the ash and the dust. It would be very expensive, but personally, I was there. I saw it. There was not enough to... They were literally vaporized is the best way to describe it,
mm-hmm.
because most of them were burnt and imploded, but there was just minute scraps of tissue and bone, And I have all the deepest respect and sympathy for Miss Diane and the people that she represents. But I was there and I saw the amount of destruction that occurred. And I think that they can find a better way to memorialize the people that passed away on 9/11 without, you know, digging up the concrete and the rubble and the ash, because that's basically what they're going to be doing.
If the lawsuit wins. But, sir, let me, you know, I don't mean to speak for the families involved here, but how small does a fragment have to be before it's treated like a piece of a body instead of being treated, as they would say, it's in the Fresh Kills landfill, like a piece of garbage?
Oh, I agree. I agree with you 100%, but I don't think that, and it's not that it's cost-effective, but I'm saying that no matter where that fragment is placed, it's not going to bring them back, and it's not going to memorialize them any better. They could create a memorial for them in a place and time without physically moving the dust, because like I say, it is so small. That's my point, is that those pieces are so small that I don't think it really is, and I don't, you know, trivialize the fact that they had to take the debris somewhere,
right?
And the fact to separate them would be a horrific, you know, task.
And Martha Moore, Bill brings up a lot of the practical questions that the people for the city have brought up and people for the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, which is the sort of quasi-governmental group in charge of the area around Ground Zero, have also brought up. Yet there is still that nagging question. There are body parts in there.
Well, exactly. And I think that what the families that are pressing the Fresh Kills issue want to do is simply what many other people do, which is to bury some ashes and believe that they represent a person that they lost, and to bury them in a place that is a cemetery or a memorial garden that is similar to a cemetery, so that they, like most other people, can go somewhere to find a marker with their son Matthew's name on it and have that place. I think every family that lost someone in the Trade Center had to decide how they wanted to memorialize or what rituals they wanted to go through. And the most common ritual that we all go through in this society is to have a funeral and a burial of something, even if it's ashes or if it's a casket. A lot of the families at the Trade Center were denied the ability to bury anything despite huge efforts by the medical examiner's office. And this is one way that they feel they could rectify that.
Bill, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Y'all have a good one. Thank you.
You too. Let's turn now to, this is Larry. Larry's calling us from Sheridan, Oregon.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
From day one, 911 has separated itself on an emotional level where we've given the families extra money. We've done so much for them.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it compare with another disaster, or say any freeway accident or an ocean liner going down or anything like that? In other words, where do we draw the line on how much money to spend?
I'm not sure how to answer that. Let me bring in another voice that may help us. Joining us now is Edward Linenthal, excuse me, a professor of history at Indiana University who's written books on how we remember the dead, including The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City, and American Memory. He's also a member of the Federal Commission for the Flight 93 Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Professor Linenthal is with us from the studios of member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
And Larry's question, I think, is probably one you've thought about.
Well, it's an insoluble question, and obvious, as we've already heard, people will answer it in very different ways. As I've listened to this discussion, my mind is going back to different sites that I've been involved with and how the presence or absence of human remains changes the terms about what you could do. And I'd like to mention briefly a few of those and then bring it back to Oklahoma City. When I was writing a book called Sacred Ground, Americans and Their Battlefields. I spent a good deal of time at Pearl Harbor and learned very quickly that the USS Arizona, which in addition to being a historic site and a shrine, is also, of course, a grave site for the men that died on the Arizona that day. And there's a kind of commemorative membrane that surrounds the Arizona, within which only certain kinds of speech can be done, commemorative rhetoric, and certainly no building of any kind can go on. And for some people, even the museum on the shore is too close to do a kind of dispassionate historical narrative, so that the presence of those men alters the terms of what the USS Arizona Memorial can be. In Shanksville, it's the formation of the memorial, which is underway now. 92% of the human remains are still in the ground at Shanksville, and they are in a fairly circumscribed area. So this sacred ground, as people call it, will be able to be set off ritually. It will be able to set off so that only family members will have access to it on ritual occasions, so the general public won't be walking about it, so that you're able to separate the rest of the park, the national park, from this charged place. The World Trade Center is such a different and incredibly more problematic place, because you do in fact have human remains that I think will continue to be found over time that for many people alter what this place can be. But so you have commemorative space charged by human remains. You have economic space. You have transportation space. You have residential space, all intersecting with one another, and sorting out whether in fact there can be a kind of commemorative zone with the human remains there that is separate, that is distinct from these other spaces, is one of the challenges that's been faced from the very beginning. In Oklahoma City, the memorial was not supposed to include any human remains at all, and in fact doesn't. But when the memorial was being planned, there were unidentified human remains that had remained in the coroner's office. And the question had to come up, and family members, survivors, the Memorial Foundation, Oklahoma City, had to struggle with, what do we do with these? Some people wanted them buried on the site. And the argument against that, which eventually won the day, was this would change the site from a memorial site to a cemetery. And ultimately, the remains were buried near the state capitol in a memorial grove. So these are very, very difficult, charged issues. And I think the question of fresh kills is so compelling and so difficult. I mean, you have on one hand issues of money. You have on the other hand the very compelling story that we heard from the family member of human ash on a garbage heap, the need to have remains to bury. Is there a way perhaps to take some of the remains without prohibitive expense and have rituals of burial at certain places so that family members will, in fact, have something of their loved ones to remember? I'm certainly not smart enough to parse all these things out, but we're dealing with very, very, very difficult and volatile razor's edge issues. And I think that the kind of conversation that's going on in this show is conversation that should go on in a much longer, more deliberate fashion between family members and various folks at levels of government to think about what realistically can be done.
A fascinating answer, and we thank you for it, but it doesn't address Larry's question. Where do you draw the line? How much money is enough? There will be memorials at the World Trade Center site, at the what's constructed there. There will be a memorial eventually at Fresh Kills. Some people ask the question, look at how much this might cost, and say, how many memorials do you need?
Well, I think it's a personal decision based on personal moral conviction. I don't think there is an answer to that question. You know, it's everybody draws the line about that in different ways. Some people would think that a shirt with the logo of the Oklahoma City National Memorial on it is a form of cheapening the memory of the dead, and they would draw the line that is commercialization. Other people would draw the line, at other places. Perhaps a family member would say, well, We don't care what we have to spend. We need something to remember, and so that our family for generations can remember. That interest, compelling interest, has to be balanced again against financial realities. So it's always a balancing act, and I don't think there is a line to be drawn. This is a negotiation and a conversation of the most painful kind.
Larry, thanks very much for the question. It's a good one.
Okay, thank you. It just seems like the emotional level of 911, these folks have been, I know I sound very callous, but these folks have been compensated and compensated and compensated compared to someone like an Oklahoma City family victim or victims, you know, family of the victim.
Yeah.
So thank you. Have a nice day.
Appreciate it. We're talking about what to do with the remains from 9/11, still a controversial subject. Our guests are Martha Moore, a national reporter for USA Today, and Edward Linenthal, a professor of history at Indiana University. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Cherie. Cherie's calling from Port Wing in Wisconsin.
Thank you. I understand and certainly empathize with the need that people have for the burial of their loved ones. I come from a mixed-blood background. I am part Native American. And in the Native American culture, it is, of course, absolutely forbidden that anyone interrupt the livelihood, if you will, of a grave that exists.
Mm-hmm.
However, my family also served in World War II, and we lost loved ones. We do not, in my family, go to other countries and demand that they make a sacred space of the place where our loved ones died. For example, my uncles, who died in as a pilot in mm-hmm. a plane crash in a foreign country, we don't go there and demand that they make this a sacred space. And I think that there comes a time when we must come to reason. And my belief is that there are so many living people in this world who are in need. And when we look at the exorbitant costs that people are expecting whatever entity it is that they expect it from to expend upon memorial or whatever, we need, I think, to sit back and look at reality and look at the needs of the world and the living people. And I know I can speak for many of my deceased family members. They would rather have us spend the money to help those who are living and struggling in this world. And I would take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Cherie. And Martha Moore, I'm not sure that any of us can comment on the feelings of other peoples of other ethnic and religious backgrounds about their dead. But in terms of the families of 9/11, how much does Diane Horning speak for other family members?
Well, I think that's difficult to say. There are almost 3,000 families that mm-hmm. Lost someone in the World Trade Center, and I'm sure that each of them have varying degrees of how much they feel that their loved one is or is not represented by what they get back from the medical examiner's office or is not at ground zero. But I do think that the desire to bury something cuts across quite a few different religious traditions. A lot of the people who died at the World Trade Center were Catholic. There were people who were Jewish. Both of those faiths, I think, focus very much on burying something. I also think there's an element of public and private in the desire of the Freshkills families to have a sacred space where the ashes can go. The attack on 9/11 was an enormously public event, and the memorial that's being built at Ground Zero will be a public place. It's a historic place. But I think, and maybe I'm just speculating, but I think there's some sentiment that it would be nice for them to have a cemetery that was about their family and their person and not about a historic event.
Hmm. Edward Linenthal, we just have a few seconds before we have to take a break, but we keep talking about sacred space, yet a space that necessarily has to be secular too.
Well, it can be charged space, powerful space, without necessarily being sacred space to any particular religious tradition. Certainly the memorial at Oklahoma City, many people consider it to be a very charged and powerful place. They use the term secular. It certainly is part of what we could think of as America's civic religious tradition that has to do with the nation and not with any particular religion.
Today, there's a new controversy over how to memorialize the victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks almost 5 years later. How should we remember the dead? Our guests are Edward Linenthal, professor of history at Indiana University, who's written on the subject of how we remember the dead, and Martha Moore, a national reporter for USA Today, who's been covering 9/11 since it began. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Michael. Michael's calling us from the Bronx in New York.
Hi, hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Michael. Go ahead,
okay.
Please.
Yes, hi. My name is Mike Burke. I'm the brother of Captain William F. Burke, Jr., Benjamin 21,
yes.
The FDNY, who gave his life on September 11th. I would like to echo what Diane has said many times, Diane Horning, about the ashen remains should be treated with dignity and respect. But I think, as you said, how do we honor their memory? We have to remember at the site how and why they died. Presently, the memorial site, as it's being called, not the 9/11 World Trade Center memorial site, but the memorial site, is dedicated to 3,000 people who died, and it won't include, from reasons unknown, it won't actually include any evidence, historical reference to 9/11 at the memorial site. So I think it's important that the way to honor them is to honor the memory of the loss and sacrifice of what happened there. And how and why they died.
Martha Moore, Michael talks about certainly has been controversial in the city of New York and elsewhere ever since these designs were first proposed.
Yes. I mean, there, as you know, there was an enormous design competition to collect ideas for how the World Trade Center, what the World Trade Center Memorial should look like. And the design that was chosen, the centerpiece of it, as you know, is two very deep pools. It's called Reflecting Absence. So it's as much about what's not there as what is there, which I think in and of itself is a commentary on how difficult it is to memorialize an event.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you have to include some history, some actual truth of what happened there. I know there was a worldwide competition, gained over 5,000 entries, but it was a 13-member jury that apparently from the 8 final results all thought alike. Every one of them was based on minimalist abstract expressionism. There was no literal reference to the attacks in any of the final 8 designs. I think what people are going there for and what America and the world needs is a literal expression of what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
They used the Vietnam Memorial as a model, but there was no battles of Vietnam fought on the Washington Mall. This is where it literally happened. I think the people need for healing is to confront 9/11 at the place that it happened, and I think that's the best way to honor, certainly to honor the sacrifice of people like my brother,
yeah.
So they know what he did there.
Edward Linenthal, I wonder what you think about this.
Well, it's an interesting question, the difference between the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the Washington Mall, which has certainly been very influential in how we think about memorialization, and memorializing at the site of violence itself. They face this issue in Oklahoma City. Do you keep a part of the wall from the Mira building? Does a beautiful memorial space soften or perhaps even trivialize the impact of such a horrific event? Or do you not want to focus on that? Do you want to focus on memory and the memory of the dead? One can do this through relics. There was certainly the talk of keeping a small portion of that last standing remnant of one of the World Trade Centers there. I think the issue of including museums and visitor centers at the places where these kinds of acts of crimes against humanity took place are really, really problematic. It's almost as if since the Holocaust, the Holocaust Museum, this first generation of activist memorial environments with museum space, educational space, commemorative space, archival space, every new memorial now has to kind of keep up with the Joneses and have a museum and a visitor center, sometimes very, very close to this charged space where human remains might might be, close to sacred space. It doesn't seem to me that that's necessarily the case at all. It seems to me that a memorial can allow visitors to inhabit its space and to deepen the kinds of issues that they bring to that space without a museum or a visitor center, that people can be in this space in silence, in a kind of awe-filled silence at the terrible events that have happened there, and do the work of memory there without necessarily having to do a history lesson at the site itself. There are other places where these things can be done. This is going to be an issue certainly at the Flight 93 Memorial as well. I find the physical proximity of memorial space and museum and visitor center space very, very problematic.
May I say something?
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I don't see what the problem, what's so problematic about it. I don't understand that at all. Memory, how the world, how the nation expresses, thinks of 9/11 is through those artifacts, through those remnants, through the facade of the building. If everybody thinks of 9/11. The picture that comes in their head is going to be the facade of that building. That's their memory of 9/11. The jury said that their task was to commemorate the accumulated memories of thousands across the globe, and then they did not include it. That one piece of steel that so genuinely and faithfully conveys the memory of all who, and people literally witnessed this event, unlike, yeah, you know, perhaps, you know,
yeah.
The other thing would be like JFK,
yep,
not even JFK assassination.
We all saw it, yeah.
Yeah, we all,
I agree. I agree absolutely with what Michael says. I think that kind of charged remnant is a very evocative and powerful, compelling thing to have at the site.
I mean, at any of the Dachau or Auschwitz, there's no discussion of whether we should include.
Yeah, it's also interesting. You were talking about the Vietnam Memorial. After it was built, there was such controversy about that a much more literal statue of three soldiers was erected nearby to reflect different views.
I would wonder which communicates to the present young people and the future young people, which communicates the meaning of Vietnam, the Vietnam War, better, Maya Lin's design or those three statues. But again, it's important, and I think this is something that has gone without note, is that there was no battles. No casualties of the Vietnam War on the Washington Mall. There's a big difference. If you were to go to Vietnam, you wouldn't remove a crashed American, remains of an American fighter plane sitting in a field somewhere, in a rice field. You wouldn't suggest that if we remove that and replace it with abstract art, we can somehow memorialize the war better.
Michael,
I don't understand why we're doing that here.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
So long. And thanks to both of our guests as well. Martha Moore, national reporter for USA Today in our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And also our thanks to Edward Linenthal, professor of history at Indiana University, author of, among other books, The Unfinished Bombing, Oklahoma City in American Memory. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Professor Linenthal was with us from the studios of WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana.